Herzlich willkommen zum On the Way to New Work Podcast. Und bevor wir heute starten, begrüßen wir unseren Werbepartner. Und das ist Hallo Freelancer. Hallo Freelancer ist ein neuer Service von Xing, der dafür sorgt, dass Unternehmen Freelancer besser rekrutieren können und dann auch effizienter mit Freelancer zusammenarbeiten können. Wir kennen das von uns selbst. Wir haben bei mir im Unternehmen tatsächlich häufig Freelancer, die wir mit einspannen für Projekte. Und was Hallo Freelancer macht ist, und das Ganze gibt es schon seit August 2018, also könnt ihr auf sehr viel Erfahrung zurückgreifen, ist, dass die auf 400.000 Freelancer in der Xing-Datenbank zurückgreifen, euch das Finden von Freelancern einfacher machen und vor allem dann wirklich den ganzen Prozess helfen mit zu managen. Also die ganzen Projektanfragen, dann die Skills anpassen, die ihr braucht. Das heißt, ihr spart extrem viel Zeit und ihr erspart euch vor allem auch dieses ganze Listenchaos und das Thema, wo packe ich die Daten hin, wo schreibe ich was auf und so weiter. Und ihr habt hier bei Hallo Freelancer eben die Möglichkeit, wie mit einem CRM-Tool und einer Matching-Software dafür zu sorgen, dass ihr im Unternehmen mit diesen Freelancern dann auch langfristig zusammenarbeitet und das Ganze eben auch sehr positiv und unterhaltsam gestaltet. Das ist das, was Hallo Freelancer bietet. Also schaut euch das Ganze mal an unter hallofreelancer.com/newwork und hier habt ihr die Möglichkeit, jetzt exklusiv für euch hier die On the Way to New Work Zuhörer, ein kostenloses White Paper zu bekommen unter diesem Link hallofreelancer.com/newwork, was euch dabei hilft zu verstehen, wie man Freelancer besser für seine Projekte gewinnt, warum sie absagen, wie man eben langfristig mit Freelancern zusammenarbeitet. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim On the Way to New Work Podcast.
Welcome to the On the Way to New Work podcast. This time it's Berlin. We are at the Singularity University Germany Summit under the title Future Speed Impact. And I'm sitting here with Aaron Frank, who's a member of the faculty. And I think you're one of the youngest members, is this right?
Correct.
I'm happy to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is great.
Maybe we start with your life so far. You're very young. You're 29, is it right?
29.
But as far as I could learn from your speech, there was something happened in this time. So
yeah, I was very fortunate as a college student. I was very confused. I didn't know what to study. I was very interested in a broad range of topics, and I actually remember. So right now, as you mentioned, I'm a full-time faculty at Singularity University. As a college student, so this was what 7 years ago. I was up late with my roommate. We were studying for finals. One night we were watching a television program. I wonder, do you know Stephen Colbert?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I follow him.
Perfect.
Especially in the last 2 years.
Yeah. So do you remember? So he had a program, his previous show called The Colbert Report. Mm-hmm. It was like a satirical news program. So that night, my roommate and I were watching, and his guest that evening was Ray Kurzweil, who is one of the two co-founders of Singularity University. And what I remember from that interview is that it completely transformed how I saw the world, how I saw the rate of technological innovation, understanding something that I'd kind of been able to perceive my whole life, this idea that we see far more happen in science and technology and innovation. You know, most of what we refer to as technology has been created in the last, you know, 30 years, 40 years. You know, that, so he was able to describe this and put to words something that I'd kind of never been able to articulate. And so from that, I said, that's where I want to be. And then,
Were you interested in high school in these topics like biology, engineering, physics?
Yeah, I mean, I was a very sort of cross-disciplinary. I had very cross-disciplinary interests. I mean, I was fascinated by, you know, space science and, you know, studying the galaxy. And I thought maybe I wanted to be an astronomer at some point. Both my brother and my father are both physicians, so some of the life sciences.
Okay, you had some technical background.
Yeah, I mean, I'd been exposed to it. But what I studied in university was more on the communication, writing, journalism, public relations side of it.
Where did you study?
I went to the University of Maryland, so right outside Washington, D.C. But yeah, and then I was really lucky. I sent basically a cold email to Singularity University at the time saying, hey, I'm 22. I find your organization and institute fascinating. I would love to be involved somehow. And I just got really lucky. There was a job opening like basically right when I emailed them and they said, ah, we're actually looking for an entry level person to come, you know, help out. It was like 15 people that worked there at the time. And that was how I got in. I started on the, you know, working in marketing and sales and did some work for the PR department. And then on the business side, grew out the partnerships team and then eventually started getting more into what I wanted to do was researching and communicating about these technologies. And then so for the past 2 years, I've become a full-time researcher, focused on a broad set of information technologies. But as you saw today, what I've talked about, a deep focus on augmented and virtual reality. So yeah, it's been just a really fortunate right time, right place, and right inspiration when I was in college.
Perfect. As I could read from your resume, you're writing for Vice, for Wired, for Forbes.
Yeah.
And you do talks for the CIA, the Department of Defense, Air Force, and so on.
Yeah.
So how's this with 29 years old? So you had this example how you were preparing yourself for standing in front of such people.
Well, yeah, so the way I originally got into virtual reality as a technology was actually because out of necessity in a way. I never planned to give public presentations. That was never a skill set I was trained for. It wasn't something that I really wanted to do. It didn't really seem that fun. It seemed really scary and intimidating. And as I mentioned on stage, when I was 23, I got kind of surprised one day with a colleague said, hey, we actually need you to give this presentation. I can't do it, so you're going to do it. And I bombed. Like, I can't begin to express how poorly that went. Like, I just stuttered for 30 minutes on stage and pointed at pictures and said, here's a thing and here's another thing. And it didn't go well. So I built a virtual reality simulation of a audience. So you could actually experience, you know, how does it feel to stand on stage in front of a room of, and in this case, it was like a video game. So it looked like cartoon audience members, but it did recreate that sensation. So I actually did use that for myself to try and improve at becoming a better, more comfortable speaker, which is, of course, one thing that I do in my role now. So, yeah, that was how I got into that. That was how I got into virtual reality. And then I started writing about it more over the course of the next, you know, few years after that.
Yeah, you started your speech with a story of the founder of Oculus Rift. Maybe you can tell us again.
Yeah,
because it's fascinating, I guess.
It is a crazy story. So Palmer Luckey, I'll caveat by saying Palmer Luckey as an individual is a bit of a peculiar person. I don't mean to speak to any of his political views. He's kind of a controversial figure, but his innovation and entrepreneurship career is a really fascinating case study. So he was a student at the University of Southern California. He was working in their VR department, working with this equipment. And the way the story goes is he was really frustrated that he could only access that equipment in the research lab and he, you know, couldn't use the same equipment in his bedroom at home. So he looked at the available technologies, and especially in a smartphone, where because of this incredible growth of the mobile phone industry in the last decade, the cost of these components have just plummeted. So you have really high resolution displays, you have batteries, accelerometers, gyroscopes, basically all of the things you need to make a high functioning virtual reality headset, repackaged it. And then what makes his story unique is that at the time, this was right at the beginning of when crowdfunding as a mechanism for raising money was coming online. So instead of trying to raise money by going to the venture community, he puts this idea for a virtual reality headset on Kickstarter and raised $2.5 million, which at the time was
amazing. It was record.
Yeah, it was at the time the most successful crowdfunding campaign. And then, so that's already a crazy conclusion to the story, right? Except for the fact, 18 months after that crowdfunding campaign, he ends up selling the whole company to Facebook for $2 billion.
Yeah.
So, you know, the speed at which that entire project materializes, unbelievable.
I remember this. It was not the first time that Mark Zuckerberg bought a company and people asked themselves, what is this?
Yeah.
But I think a couple of years later, we can imagine how important this will be. But maybe you give us your view on augmented and virtual reality. Maybe you explain the difference for some of our listeners who doesn't know exactly and why you believe it will change almost everything.
Yeah. So so it's a good question. So what is the difference between augmented and virtual reality? And also the distinction, the fact that we have two distinct words to describe these technologies kind of speaks to the early days of where this bases. We don't really have good words for this, but most of the time when people are referring to virtual reality, that largely refers to an experience where you're entirely immersed in a headset. So you're completely shut off from your physical surroundings, but you're immersed in this digital, you know, computational world. Whereas on the other hand, augmented reality, you're still connected to your surroundings. You're still there, but you might have some either audio or visual information included in your experience. So a good example of this is Google Glass. Many people are familiar with. That's a good example of augmented reality, where you know you're still in the real world, but you have this computer screen in your field of vision, which gives you information.
What do you think? Why did Google Glass failed?
Yeah, I think it's pretty. It was pretty much I would argue and a lot of people would agree that the single biggest roadblock or the barrier was the cultural acceptance of the fact that, you know, if you go into I remember the first time I went into a grocery store in Palo Alto and I saw someone wearing a pair of Google glasses and I avoided them like the plague, right? I don't want to.
Such a glass hole.
Yeah, exactly. That's what this term, glass hole, I think really does capture the experience well. Like, you don't know, are they filming me? Are, you know, there's this weird, separation between this person and they have a computer on their face. I think the cultural acceptance
just too early. Yeah, they were just too early.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that I can tell that there's a computer on their face, whereas like you're wearing a pair of really nice, designer glasses. They look
Warby Parker.
Oh, perfect.
I'm from Germany, but I love this brand. Yeah,
that's great. Do Germans know?
We know the story. Yeah,
yeah,
it's cool.
It's a great company. So imagine when you know you can get a pair of Google Glass that has the same functionality, but in the form factor of a nice pair of Warby Parker, that doesn't create that same cultural gag reflex. I would argue that's probably one of the biggest reasons that Google Glass failed, aside from the fact that it was expensive, wasn't really clearly obvious what you could use with it. And then the cultural sort of context around what it's like to be seen wearing them, I think, was not quite ready.
I had the privilege when I think a couple of weeks before it was launched to I was guest to one of the executive of Google in Palo Alto at his with a grill party, and then the PR head of PR of Google came in with Google glasses, putting a finger on the side, and we're talking, and then I could really experience it. My first reaction was, well, this is the best thing for B2B. So let's imagine, so you talked about, we come to this later, about the NBA finals. The coach of an NBA team is wearing these glasses and he looks at his players and he sees all data.
Yeah.
And he could see, okay, how many balls did he throw in the wrong direction? Mm. Or what is his pulse? Whatever. Or for other things. And you mentioned the HoloLens of Microsoft, which I think they've started much more in this B2B aspect.
Yeah.
You had the ThyssenKrupp example. Maybe you explain this a little bit.
Yeah. Need your assistance on the pronunciation. Pascal, the moderator of the event, was coaching me. But so ThyssenKrupp.
Perfect.
There
it's,
it is.
It's my client. So
great.
I know it very good.
Yeah. So they have an experiment underway looking at how using the hands-free nature of working with an augmented reality pair of glasses like the HoloLens can improve the efficiency of their field technicians when they go out to do elevator repairs. Traditionally, the way, repairs are conducted is you need a two-dimensional user manual. You need a piece of paper that, you're referring to this piece of paper, and then you're flipping into working with the elevator and back and forth, and it, creates cognitive dissonance and it takes time. And we can talk about, you asked earlier, what's the, why will these technologies transform the world? I think because of the fact that the information depicted in an augmented or virtual reality world is three-dimensional, that can't be overstated as why that's really significant. But in the case of ThyssenKrupp, is getting three-dimensional information about the elevator, about what the repairs that need to be done in real time, hands-free, without having to rely on a user manual, they've been able to improve their efficiency, taking tasks that normally would take upwards of an hour and have been able to do the same task in 20 minutes. And that's just one example. I think there's really clear evidence that working with augmented reality heads-up display information, allowing you to basically eliminate any kind of user manual, just improves efficiency for technical work in a really dramatic way. And that, I think, will have a big impact on, you know, all kinds of businesses and industries.
Yeah, so the example, Mercedes-Benz augmented reality, they use this for their manual. I think the driver's manual in a Mercedes is up to 1,000 pages, and I think it's much more smart to do it this way. Yeah.
I think that's fascinating too, is that's for consumers, right? Like that's you buying a car that you will no longer be given a user manual, that the expectation will be that you'll just have all that information on either your smartphone or maybe in the future some kind of pair of glasses, but that's how you interact with your car and how to, you know, your phone will be showing you, here's how the car works and here's how to, you know, make the car do what you want it to do. I think that's really interesting.
What do you expect in augmented reality? What will be the next steps? What will happen in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think what we're going to see is a slow progression of finding the places in society where it makes sense to use augmented reality. I think for the near term, we will see a lot of these technologies basically contained within the work environment, within a business environment. I don't think we're quite at a point culturally where, you know, it'll be routine for people to have at least augmented reality on their face, either in a pair of glasses. But you will see that in a working environment, in the, you know, examples we're describing. I think for the next few years, it's very likely that augmented reality will basically remain on our phones. So you see a huge development platform war happening between companies like Apple and Google, who are building these platforms for developers to build augmented reality. But for the next few years, I think what that means for us as consumers is that for our windows into these augmented reality worlds will still be something that we use our phones to access. And I think what's really fascinating, a good question to ask, like you're asking, is, so what does that mean? What will be the ways in which we use these systems? From a business standpoint, it's a little more obvious because we're starting to see really interesting experiments. From a consumer standpoint, what are the ways that we use these technologies just in our everyday lives? That's a much more difficult question to answer, and I honestly don't know, but I'm really fascinated to see what will be the big use cases that people start using these in their everyday lives for.
Yeah. Coming to virtual reality, so you mentioned Ready Player One.
Yeah.
It's one of your, so at the end of our podcast, we always ask our guests about their five main books they would recommend. I guess Ready Player One is one of this. Maybe you explain us why.
Yeah, sure. So Ready Player One, for those that aren't familiar with the story, it was published in 2012 as a first-time author named Ernest Cline, who wrote this story about this future world. I believe it takes place in the 2040s, maybe, where most people's interactions happen in this online virtual world. So it's an entire, what's, you know, often called a metaverse, this entire three-dimensional virtual world where people can access by placing themselves inside a virtual reality headset. And what's really fascinating about this story is it really does a fascinating job of depicting what a life might look like in a world where people are spending most of their social, recreational, and business time inside a virtual world. For a business audience, I actually do recommend this book because one of the things I find really fascinating in Ready Player One is the business models that exist that are depicted in this future world. Like, if you pay attention in the book, what people are paying money for inside virtual reality is actually a very, I think, a really clever depiction, and I think probably a good indicator for what business models will look like in virtual worlds like in Ready Player One. The other thing to point out about this book, maybe two things. One, when Facebook acquired Oculus, every new employee that starts a job within the Oculus department at Facebook, they're issued a copy of this book. So this is the book that these employees are given to read. The other thing to mention, though, is this book was written largely as a sort of a cautionary tale. And what I mean by that is the world that exists in this story, the backdrop is that it's really not a very good place to be. This, you know, society is kind of fallen apart. The environment has collapsed. The political climate is, you know, brutal. And it's kind of this story about, here's what could end up happening if we don't take care of the real world. We'll kind of will descend into these virtual worlds. So it's actually a story of what we should maybe want not to aspire to. I don't think we want to move into a world where all of our time is spent in an online virtual environment. And it's a story really about how valuable and precious the real world is and how we should take care of it. But it is a fascinating book. I think if you're interested in augmented and virtual reality, this is definitely a good place to start to get exposed to it.
Very cool. Maybe we add this question now. So there are some scientists which say that VR has the potential to make people really addicted, like heroin, cocaine, stuff like this. Do you believe in this, or is it that people get really addicted to be in virtual reality?
Yeah, it's a question that comes up quite often. I'll be honest, I'm not too familiar with any of the research around VR addiction. I think one of the things about this is it's also quite new. I mean, the market for virtual reality today is so small. Like the Oculus Rift and the HTC Vive, the two biggest, most popular PC-based VR, and then of course there's the PlayStation VR. There's not even, I mean, there's only several million total units like in the world. So there's not that many people using VR today. It's very small. I mean, it surprises people to hear that. I think that'll change. Facebook just came out even just a few weeks ago with their what's called Oculus Go. It's a standalone headset that has all the same functionality. It's instead of spending $2,000, it costs $200, and wow, you don't need the expensive PC and the wires and the, you know, the positional tracking is just on the headset. So
you need the smartphone or
no? Everything. All the compute power is just right in the device. Wow. So there are technologies that are coming online, which I would expect will grow this market. But that said, we already have a world where there's challenges around things like internet addiction. You know, people that spend so much time on the internet or playing these, multiplayer online video games like Warcraft that, are so addictive that people are consumed by them. If we look at what's, happened in in that space, it does exist, but it is a very small percentage of the total users of, internet users. It's not something I really am concerned about. And the reason I'm not concerned about, I mean, anecdotally, in my own experience, if I spend a lot of time in VR, I'm so motivated to just go outside. I notice this, if I'm working on an article and I have to do some research and spend time in VR, I will routinely afterwards take my headset off and just that's the time where I'm most likely to call up a friend and go meet up for drinks or go outside. And I think just like we use Skype and phones and video conferencing today, or we have video games that we spend a lot of time in, I think we will be able to create these lives of balance between spending time in VR and the real world. So it doesn't consume my fears that much.
Okay.
Und bevor es gleich mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast weitergeht, hier die kurze Werbeunterbrechung. Und wir haben hier unseren Werbepartner EnBW Mobility Plus, die App von EnBW. EnBW ist, wie ihr vielleicht aus einer der letzten Folgen schon wisst, nicht einfach nur ein Anbieter für Strom und Gas, sondern eben auch Energielösungen für Elektromobilität und Solar. Und wenn ihr jetzt denkt, interessiert mich aber nicht, weil was brauche ich von Elektromobilität, dann denkt dran, das ist ja die Zukunft. Denn wenn man einfach überall und zuverlässig wissen will, wo Ladestationen sind, dann könnt ihr diese App auch jetzt schon mal ausprobieren und nutzen. Das heißt, wer von euch einen Verbrennungsmotor noch fährt, soll ja vorkommen im Jahr 2019, für den hat EnBW diese App gebaut, denn ihr habt hier einen Fahrsimulator und könnt nachschauen, wie ihr tatsächlich von Station zu Station kämet bei dem normalen Fahrverhalten, das ihr habt. Also sprich, ihr nehmt die Fahrdaten, nehmt die App und könnt mit dieser App dann eben sehen, wie weit ihr kommt. Das zweite ist, ihr könnt Ladestationen darüber finden, logisch, dafür ist die App ja da. Und wenn ihr selber schon ein Elektroauto habt, auch mit der App bezahlen. Also schaut es euch einfach mal an, einfach mal ausprobieren. Elektromobilität ist ganz klar die Zukunft und heute schon alltagstauglich. EnBW Mobility Plus App einfach mal runterladen, installieren und testen. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit der Folge.
Yeah, let's talk more about the potential you see and I see as well. So you mentioned Google Expeditions, an example I did not know. Please explain this. It was very fascinating.
Yeah. So Google Expeditions is an experiment being done at Google around developing teaching tools for teachers of primary school education to be able to give these students access to field trips in virtual reality. For the last few years, Google has been developing systems where teachers can teach their students about, say, you know, the Great Barrier Reef or Yosemite National Park, or they have a virtual experience where you can go and get a tour of the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world, or even things that don't even exist. You know, one of the benefits of virtual reality is you can create things in software. You can get a tour of ancient Greece as a student. And what's unique about
this... You can land on the moon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, something that you might see in a video or see a picture of, but imagine being able to be placed in a virtual environment and actually experience that. And so the way that these systems are built is to provide a way for teachers to use these tools to augment the way they teach about things in the world. And so there's a lot of research ongoing right now about the efficacy. Does it engage students to participate and want to learn about things in a way that may have been boring in the past? Actually, when I was a kid, one of my favorite television programs, I wonder, do you have this in Germany? It's called the Magic School Bus. Do you know this?
No.
It's an American cartoon education.
We had Sesame Street.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean that's a classic. The way the Magic School Bus works is it was a show about a teacher who had this school bus which could take her students on these like really wild field trips. Like there was my favorite episode where they shrunk the students in the bus down to the size of a blood cell, and you get a tour of the human body.
Amazing.
By actually, you know, shrinking down. And so what virtual reality is basically now become like that Magic School Bus. There are all kinds of education applications where you can get a tour of the human digestive system or the circulatory system or the respiratory system by becoming the same size as, you know, someone... navigating inside the human body. And it is a far more immersive way to learn about something like the human body by experiencing it yourself than, you know, reading about it in a textbook. And so Google Expeditions is a really cool sort of early experiment to see how that actually helps teachers, or does it help teachers to teach students?
I totally buy this. I read an article of Peter Drucker, which he wrote in 1999, where he wrote the question, how do I learn? And I never thought about this topic, how do I learn? There are people who are good in reading, others are good in watching movies, others are good in doing, and they learn just if they do it. There are even people who have to talk. So I had a partner who was always talking 2 to 3 hours about a topic, and he needed people around him. And I get crazy. I couldn't. And now I say, well, I just did not know that this is a way to learn. And we had one guest in our podcast when I asked him the question, what are your favorite books? He said, I don't read books. I watch YouTube videos with 1.6 speed. So faster videos. And I think that in virtual reality, there is a huge potential to reimagine the world and all the new topics. And I believe this. You had another very nice example, which was Tribe, this DJ experience. Maybe you explain this.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite. This was really clicked for me because for years, people that have talked about the potential of virtual reality very obviously have pointed out, oh, this will be a great way to educate people. And the examples was always given, like, oh yeah, imagine you're a child and you want to, you know, learn about ancient Greece and get a tour. Like, yeah, that makes sense. But when I visited this company in San Francisco, they're called Tribe VR. What really clicked for me is that actually the real powerful impact of augmented and virtual reality for education won't be learning by seeing things or being exposed to experiences, but will be to actually learn things by doing them in augmented and virtual reality. So specifically what Tribe looked at was the industry around the YouTube tutorial business, which is apparently a massive industry, the advertising revenues, the kinds of things people turn to YouTube to learn new skills range from how to cook, how to play guitar, how to do repairs on a car, how to set up their Wi-Fi router, how to tie a bow tie, all of these things that is just a massive industry that people watch videos on YouTube. So what augmented virtual reality allow for is you can actually work with these environments by using your own hands, and that's a really big deal. So what Tribe has started, their first application is around music. And they're training, they're using virtual reality to train people how to use DJ booths or like DJ controllers. So the video I showed earlier was essentially the first time in my life that I'd ever been placed in front of a DJ controller. And because it was in virtual reality, I put on my headset, I am using my own hands. There's a tutorial that's guiding me and showing me here's how to press play, here's where you place the music, here's the crossfader, here's how to toggle between different albums, all those knobs and dials, here's what this one does, here's the treble, here's the bass, here's how to, they teach you how to do a drop, electronic music thing, whatever. And what was really fascinating is when I pulled off the headset and I came out of the environment, they placed me in front of a real DJ controller. And I now knew exactly how it worked. I now, within 5 minutes of actually using my own hands to actually learn how to work this thing, I didn't have to watch any YouTube videos. And the other thing that I found really fascinating is I was able to work with this DJ controller in virtual reality without having to buy my own DJ controller because it's just software. So, the fact that in software, you can build basically anything you want. I could build a Mercedes car, and I could learn how to modify it myself if I'm a car hobbyist by changing car parts without actually owning my own Mercedes. And I think that's the real, sort of killer application for virtual reality education, is to learn by doing things instead of learn by watching other people explain how to do things.
We have to talk about Pokemon Go. It was one of your topics was augmented geography,
yeah.
Pokemon Go was your example. So in Germany we had a period where many people played it. I think now it's some more quiet, but yeah. I think it was fascinating. Maybe you can tell us what is the fascinating thing about it, and what do you expect in this area in the future?
I think this topic, this idea of how. So Pokemon Go is a very specific type of augmented reality, what we could call location-based augmented reality, where you tie digital information to physical places in the real world. I think this topic for me is one of the most fascinating areas in this entire space. Like if I had to find a sub-specialty within this area, I think this is where I would pursue. Because what I think is really fascinating, and there's a few examples, and I'm trying to collect more research around some examples of this, where, and the story I told on stage, I think is a really helpful one, where, so my girlfriend lives in Amsterdam, and actually the reason I play Pokemon Go is I was never into Pokemon when I was a kid. I'd never really planned on playing it, but she was a big fan. She got me into it and it became addictive. Anyway, so there's a coffee house in Vondelpark in Amsterdam that,
that's the story I want to hear.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. So I remember we used to go to this coffee house. It's called the Blue Tea House. It's in the middle of Vondelpark. Maybe some of your listeners have been there. They know it. We went in 2015 when we first started dating. We used to go that summer, and it was always, pretty empty. Like we'd be able to find a seat. It was fine. The next year, the next summer, Pokemon Go had just come out, and you could not find a seat. You couldn't get a seat at this place. And the reason is in Pokemon Go, there was a weird thing that happened where there were three Pokestops, which in the game, if you're not familiar, are the things that you have to walk to collect the items that sat right on the Blue Tea House. So what that meant is that Pokemon Go players who were very lazy, that didn't want to have to walk around, could basically just sit at this coffee house and just spin these Pokestops and catch all the Pokemon that came without having to walk around. And then, of course, you can sit, buy coffee, and drink, and hang out with friends. And it's just, okay, so think about for a moment. If you're the owner of the Blue Tea House, you see what, I don't know, but like maybe they tripled their revenue that one summer. They didn't change a single thing about the physical world. They didn't get better Wi-Fi network. They didn't have to worry about reviews on TripAdvisor. They didn't have to get a new coffee recipe. They didn't have to get, renovate their bathroom, nothing. They didn't change anything about the physical world. And because of this invisible digital universe of Pokemon Go, we see this impact to their business. And this is, I think, one of the most fascinating impacts of Pokemon Go that's going to change real estate prices. Another story is my girlfriend and I, our favorite date in San Francisco is to ride the buses in the city. The reason is the buses actually drive slow enough that you can catch all of the Pokemon that spawn. And we thought, we're very clever. We're the only ones doing this. That wasn't true. We actually used to see couples riding the buses in San Francisco all the time playing Pokemon. And the San Francisco Transportation Authority noticed this, and they started promoting playing Pokemon Go as a great reason to ride the buses. So now you're seeing meaningful revenue increases to a public transportation system because of this augmented reality video game. I think that is such a fascinating idea that there are people who just basically get on airplanes to fly around the world playing Pokemon,
like you did. Not exactly.
Yeah, not quite. It was a work trip, but that's fair. I think the intersection between physical space and where we as consumers, where we go, why we go there, what we do when they get there, that's changed, not because of anything about the physical world, but because of this invisible digital augmented reality world, is such a weird future that we're going to have to navigate. And I know I talked a lot about Pokemon Go, but it's not just Pokemon Go that we're going to see this happen.
Do you have other examples that companies already are using this technology to influence their customers?
So there's a couple that come to mind. There's one company in London that's actually maybe the most successful non-Pokemon location-based augmented reality game. It's a game called Snatch. The way Snatch works, it's basically Pokemon Go, but instead of catching Pokemon, you catch these parcels, and inside these parcels are prizes that different brands and companies have worked. So let's say Nintendo might put a Nintendo Switch somewhere in the city of Berlin, and you can go and find them, or maybe Starbucks will put a discount for a free cup of coffee in the city. And the way Snatch works is the design is if you find a parcel in the city, you get to keep whatever is inside of it as long as you can hold that parcel for 6 hours. And as a game, if I have the app and I see that, you have a parcel and you're sitting next to me, I can try and steal them from you. Now, what they've done is they've partnered with businesses in London. So let's say a bar, where a certain bar in London might be a safe zone, where if I go and sit there for 6 hours, no one could steal what I've collected. And so people are doing this. People are now going and sitting at a bar to play this augmented reality game, spending money yeah. in the real world. So that's one example. I know Vodacom, it's a subsidiary, and I just learned about this last week when I was in South Africa. A subsidiary of Vodafone did experimental marketing concept where they hid some prize, kind of like Pokemon Go, out in the world, and incentivizing people to go and go to Vodacom retail stores to sign up for new businesses or get a Vodacom account, and they had they'd hidden money, $1,000 US or something, out at different retail locations for Vodacom stores. But these are just gaming examples.
Yeah, but
we're gonna have
shows the potential.
Shows the potential. And it's not just gonna be gaming. It's gonna be, I'm gonna be able to leave instructions for my parents when they land at the airport in San Francisco to, pull up their phone, and I'll have tied digital information about how to, find the car rental at the San Francisco airport. Here, follow these instructions. That's, location relevant information that I was able to tie to a physical place in the real world that helped them navigate that environment. And, again, this is something that I don't know what the use case for something like location augmented reality will be. Right now, all the examples that we have are games like Pokemon Go, but in the future, I think it will go way beyond gaming and will really transform how we relate to physical space in really interesting ways.
Und bevor es gleich mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast weitergeht, hier die kurze Werbeunterbrechung für unseren Werbepartner Blinkist. Blinkist ist eine App, mit der ihr über 2.500 internationale Sachbuchbestseller innerhalb von 15 Minuten erfassen könnt. Das sind nämlich Zusammenfassungen von Büchern zu allen möglichen Themen. Das können Leadership-Bücher sein, Biografien, Psychologie, Ratgeber und so weiter. Also alles Mögliche, was man eben doch gerne mal lesen möchte. Und ihr kennt das vielleicht, häufig hat man diese Bücher stapelweise neben dem Bett liegen oder nimmt sie mit in Urlaub oder hat sie in der App und möchte sie lesen, kommt aber nicht dazu, weil es natürlich auch noch tausend andere Themen gibt. Dann bekommt ihr hier eben die Zusammenfassung in 15 Minuten. Außerdem am Ende von jedem Titel konkrete Handlungsanweisungen und etwas, was auch hier in den Zuhörer-Feedbacks immer wieder kommt, Lifehacks für die Produktivität. Großartig. Das Ganze gibt es auf Deutsch und auf Englisch. Schaut da mal rein, Buch auswählen, einfach mal ausprobieren. Das Ganze ist kostenlos zum Testen, also die Möglichkeit, das einfach mal auszuprobieren. Jeden Monat kommen so an die 50 Titel hinzu. Das können Titel sein wie die 7 Wege zur Effektivität oder eben Biografien, wie schon gesagt, alles Mögliche dabei, wie ich Dinge geregelt kriege. Also wirklich extrem viel dabei. Schaut jetzt mal auf die Website blinkist.de/newwork, denn dort bekommt ihr 25% Rabatt auf das Jahresabo. Wie schreibt man das Ganze? blinkist.de/newwork. blinkist.de/newwork. Raufschauen, angucken, ausprobieren. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit der Folge.
Let's switch to your last part of your presentation, the shared virtual experiences. I'm not quite sure if you started with Second Life, but you had Second Life as an example, and I was really fascinated that
it's
still alive.
In the very beginning.
But it's still alive.
It's huge. It's massive.
Yeah.
So Second Life, I was really fascinated. It's always the example that's held up as a, look at this online virtual world. And we talked earlier about Ready Player One. You could point to Second Life as a really good example of like an early prototype of the metaverse that is depicted in Ready Player One. Second Life is huge today. So, most people, when I talk about these ideas, ask me, whatever happened to Second Life? 15 years ago, the media was obsessed with it. They were saying, everyone's going to have an account on Second Life. Everyone's going to have an office in Second Life. Everyone's going to have their job in Second Life. That never really was the case. That never really occurred. But Second Life today is still so big. There's still about a million monthly active users, which was at its peak. It was that actually was what it peaked at. Is still, it basically hit this hockey stick growth curve and then hit this plateau, but it hasn't dropped off. It's still the same million users. and the in-game economy of Second Life in 2017 was $500 million.
Amazing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So it's huge. There's really fascinating communities in Second Life. If anyone's interested in getting an update, The Atlantic did a really nice feature story last December. So December 2017, there's a really good feature article, basically looking at how people are still using Second Life and what it's there for. And there's some really fascinating stories in there about ways people use it, but it's still a huge phenomenon.
Cool. You talked about other shared virtual experiences. Did I get it right that you did a podcast in VR?
Yeah. So there's a comedian in the United States. He's his name is Duncan Trussell. He's got his own fairly successful podcast, and he had he wanted to do an experiment where he recorded one of his episodes live in front of a live audience inside virtual reality. So he had me and one of my other coworkers, another faculty by the name of Ramez Nam. We met him in a platform called AltSpace, and we recorded a podcast in live in front of a room of people that were there virtually, but were spread across, cool, all over the world. Yeah, it was a really interesting experience.
And you had this election example from the US. How did this work?
So AltSpace. So AltSpace is a company just acquired by Microsoft recently, but they, for the last few years, have been creating ways for people to experience things online in a virtual environment together. So one of their first experiments was they built a virtual recreation of Rockefeller Plaza, a Rockefeller Center in New York, and that whole plaza. And what they used that space during the U.S. election to do. They had press conferences there, and they did a live taping, or sort of live showing of the first presidential debate. So what that meant is that as a user, I basically put on my Oculus Rift, I was taken to a virtual recreation of Rockefeller Plaza where I could interact with other people as avatars, and you can walk around the space and talk to them. And then there was a big screen where they were showing and broadcasting a live feed of the presidential debate. And it was basically like going to a, you know, I want to say like a rock concert. It was pretty dystopian. It was the U.S. political climate in VR. So it's no less dystopian there.
But people
than
watch
the real
dystopias
world.
In movies as well. So
yeah. But it was really fascinating to, you know, meet people from all over the world and, you know, watch this in virtual reality. And yeah, that was one of the first experiences I had. Really. Sharing an experience with other people. And it's probably worth noting that actually, so just this past week was a really big announcement in this world of sharing experiences together. Facebook just launched a platform called Venues, which is instead of in the example of AltSpace, which I showed was a virtual environment, what Facebook has done has put 360 cameras at real locations. So their first location was the Red Rocks Amphitheater in Denver. It's a really famous, beautiful concert venue. And they show, you could actually attend, their first one was a Vance Joy, the Australian performer, the musician, was a Vance Joy concert. But what was unique about it is you could attend this concert live at Red Rocks in Denver, but you could do that with other people. Yeah. So you could actually do it socially. You could actually sit there as a virtual avatar at this real location, not a virtual recreation, and do that with other people and create the shared social experience of that. And that's the first time that there's the real live action with the social component. That's never been merged before. And so that was actually just happened for the first time last week. And I was bummed I missed it, but I'm going to go home and have access to my Oculus, and they'll have more events later this summer.
I mean, what does this mean? You talked in your speech about Golden State Warriors. I'm a fan of this team.
Good, I guess.
What, did you watch the game last night?
No, it's too late. It's like 3 a.m.
you heard about it?
Yeah.
Steph Curry, 9 3-pointers.
Yeah,
I think it's a record.
Yeah, the finals record.
Will we see NBA finals in VR in 5 years?
Today, you can already. There's a platform called NextVR. They are already broadcasting NBA games live in virtual reality. If you have a VR headset, you can go and feel like you're sitting courtside and go to different camera angles. This was actually one of the first. The NBA is a really interesting,
progressive,
innovative sports body, and they for the past, I think this is even the second season where you could basically watch live NBA games entirely in virtual reality. What they're missing, though, is the social component. So you can't do that. Like you and I, you couldn't be here in Berlin, and I'm in San Francisco, and we could watch together. But
it will happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But already, you can already go and watch the NBA finals.
Last question. So you work in a university, which is for so many people like all of us here in Berlin, the source of inspiration right now. How do you get inspiration?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm so fortunate that I am just constantly surrounded by interesting people. Like I remember when I was, this goes back to when I first started at Singularity University, I honestly couldn't believe when I first showed up. Like, I remember my first week on the job, I met an astronaut who had been in space. I met the futurist for the FBI who was in charge of, you know, projecting all the potential cyber threats for, you know, the U.S., intelligence community. I met, really interesting biotechnologists who were working on DNA platforms for, programming, even life. This is just like the average day. I'm very, very fortunate. I don't mean to, suggest that this is like a common thing. I know how fortunate I am. And so it's very easy to remain inspired being so consumed by an environment where there's so much interesting things happening at a speed. this has actually become one of my favorite interview questions when we're looking at hiring people at Singularity University. I love asking people is like, what's the last thing that you came across that really surprised you or blew your mind? It doesn't even need to be like a tech thing or, you know, but, and I love that question because you can really get a sense of, you know, where people are spending time learning or reading about. And for me, I have my mind blown like every week, just talking to different people in different spaces, whether it's artificial intelligence or robotics. And I think, you know, there's so much happening and I think a place like Singularity University is interesting because it's like a convening body. It's like the water cooler, like the oasis that brings so many different kinds of technologists together to look at the intersection, and being kind of at the middle of that is such a really cool opportunity.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Any questions do you have for me or
This is I'd be curious what from the day so far, is there anything that I'd like to ask you this question. Like, is there anything like that's really surprised you? I love getting that sense of like what surprised you.
Or I really have to say that your speech surprised me, and because I have two, as I mentioned to you, two boys, 19, 22, very much into gaming, and you surprised me because you're so young at age, but you have so much experience in this field, so much interest, so much passion, and the way you were presenting your topic, and this is the same for your colleagues, was really, really touching. And so the first half day was amazing, and I'm happy that we still have some more speeches to see and
that's
to go.
Awesome. Yeah.
And I met Red Kurzweil
as
well. Yeah, when we were in Mountain View, I think 2 or 3 years ago, and last year. Every year I do a trip with colleagues from the agency industry in Germany and some clients. And this was the first time.
Was he at Google by that point?
Yeah. It was 3 years ago.
Okay, so,
And last time we met some staff members of Singularity. There was a lady, she was digital biologist. Mm. This really kicked me off. So what in biology with digital stuff is possible at this time?
Yeah.
But I think the whole thing, so your CEO and co-founder who talked to us about his consulting thing with Harman Kardon and Samsung. So, because the good thing is that you have the perspective what will happen 10, 20, 30 years in advance, but you bring it back to what can we do now? And this whole ambition or notion of let's do things, let's stop talking, let's embrace the future. This really.
Are your kids interested in the same kinds of topics?
Yeah, they are. They are, and so I told them whenever they want to do a coding course or do a Singularity thing, they just get the money for it.
And you think that they might have a path towards getting into some kind of technology or innovation?
They started both in the direction of communication, but they do it with this technical technology
cool.
approach.
Yeah, and I can definitely.
I think it's cool to be 20 to 30 in these days, because you will really see so much change. But the good thing is that with all these technologies, as someone like me who's 53, there's no reason to not go the same path. There's no reason. I think it's much easier to learn new things. No? As the way you prepare your sessions is so much better. I'm curious. I believe the future has more opportunities than threats, but we will have to face them as well. So,
Great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. This is really fun.